You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, folks. I want to tell you about a podcast that I think you'll love. It's called Gastropod. It combines two of my favorite things, science and history. Specifically, the history of my third favorite thing, actually, maybe my first favorite thing, food. But really, it's about all the weird and wonderful things you never knew about what you eat every day. The two hosts, Cynthia and Nikki, are delightfully funny and charming, and they take you on deep dives into the most curious topics, like whether New York City bagels are better because of the water, or what scientists are discovering about the link between diet and Alzheimer's. Want to know why American mangoes taste so bad and what that has to do with George W. Bush and Harley Davidson's? They've got that covered, too. In fact, one of their latest episodes is probably one of my new favorites. It's all about airplane food. Yes, airplane food. And it gets into how we went from fine dining in the skies to lukewarm mystery meat under tinfoil. And they also explore the science of how cabin pressure affects our sense of taste and how those little packets of nuts became such a staple of commercial air flight. It's just fascinating, and I love it when I learn something, but it feels like I'm just listening to someone tell a great story. That's Gastropod. The New York Times, Wired, TED Talks, they've all chosen Gastropod as one of their favorite podcasts. It's one of my favorites, too. So subscribe to Gastropod on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.
American history is full of infamous people, places, and events like the Salem Witch Trials and the Black Sox baseball scandal, Alcatraz Prison and the Bermuda Triangle, D.B. Cooper and Bonnie and Clyde and Lee Harvey Oswald. I'm Chris Wimmer. Join me on the Infamous America podcast for stories of some of the darker and more controversial chapters of American history, all told with cinematic music and sound design. Subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. All of America, or I should say most of America, was shocked and horrified on January 6, 2021, when alt-right protesters violently invaded the U.S. Capitol, resulting in 140 injuries and 5 deaths. It was a crisis unlike anything in our history, but it didn't come out of nowhere, and it wasn't without warning. As conspiracy theorists like QAnon spread like a virus through the Republican Party over the past 5 years, many supporters of Donald Trump grew increasingly hostile and violent both in their speech and their actions. But according to my guest today, the roots of January 6th go much farther back than that, and he delves into the history of this in his new podcast, Fate of Fact. Today I'm happy to welcome Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian John Meacham back to the show to discuss the rumblings of conservative discontent that go back to the Nixon and Goldwater eras, how the GOP succeeded in squelching the John Birchers in the 60s but failed to control the radical elements in the party today, and whether or not the Republican Party can be salvaged. Plus, John shares what his late friend George H.W. Bush thought of Donald Trump and the rise of the alt-right, the future of QAnon, and much more. Coming up with John Meacham in just a moment. Beecham is a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer. He is a distinguished visiting professor at Vanderbilt University, a contributing writer for the New York Times Book Review, and a fellow of the Society of American Historians. He is also the host of the podcasts Hope Through History and It Was Said, and now he's out with a new five-part documentary podcast called Fate of Fact. John Meacham, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, John Adams famously said, facts are stubborn things, but you argue on your show that they're not as stubborn as they used to be. And in fact, you trace the evolution or devolution of truth in politics in Fate of Fact. You certainly seem to be a man on a mission, John. What is your goal with this podcast?
Well, yes, the facts are not as stubborn as Adams would have wanted or as we would want them. The mission is pretty straightforward. America's at her best when we actually agree on the contours of reality. We can then disagree and should about what to do about that reality. But we spin off into chaos and even autocracy when half the country decides they're not going to engage with the evidence of their eyes, but they're just going to make stuff up. And we're seeing that in the most vivid, most tangible, most ambient ways right now. And so my goal here is not to argue for some crazy liberal departure in American history, but to argue for what is fundamentally, in classical terms, a conservative interpretation of the world, which is, as Edmund Burke had it, you address reality as you find it. You are skeptical of broad-ranging reforms because of the law of unintended consequences, but you at least dwell in an observable and fact-based universe. And I think we're in a place where it's not both sides. It could be. The left could go nuts this afternoon. Anything can happen, but they haven't yet. And what I wanted to do in the podcast is sort of give people, for what it's worth, my interpretation of the road to January 6th and this enduring cult of personality with the greeter at Mar-a-Lago.
Well, there's also sort of a paradox here in that the people who most need to hear this message are the very people who are most likely to shut down and dismiss it out of hand. So my question to you is, how do you reach them?
Yeah, no, it's a fabulous question. I had an old, there was an old civil rights reporter who worked for Newsweek magazine for a long time, was in Birmingham, Montgomery, everywhere. He was based out of Atlanta. And I asked him once back in the 90s, did you have a political agenda when you were covering the movement? And he said, you didn't have to have an agenda. You just tell them the damn truth, and the truth's bad enough. So I understand the point. I also believe that you can't coddle people. You can compromise with people, but you can only compromise when you have a shared set of values. And right now, there's not a shared set of values. Their value is the classic will to power, right? Their incentive structure is holding on to enough votes, holding on long enough that they will once again be in control broadly of the fate of the nation. What we have seen and knew is that this is not a 60-40 country. It's really never been a 60-40 country. There have only been three presidential elections since World War II where a candidate got 60% of the vote. Three. Nixon in 72, Johnson in 64, and Reagan in 84. We're much more a 51-49, 52-48 country, which is where Biden is. And if it weren't for the voters of Georgia, this would be a radically different conversation and a radically different moment. But that's okay, right? I mean, that's democracy. Democracy is that if you're on one side and I'm on the other, and you win on this given day, I accept that result, and then I muster my forces to try to beat you the next day. But I accept the rules of the game. The Republican Party, in the age of Trump, has decided that if the rules run against them, they won't simply play by those rules to win again, but they'll just dismiss them, blow through them. And so if you believe in the country, and I do, you believe that we are fallen, frail, and fallible, right? We're all sinful. We're all driven by appetite and ambition. And the point of the country is to limit those appetites and ambitions just enough to see if we can get to the greatest good for the greatest number. And right now we are, but it is a genuine 50-50 thing. Right? It was not even 51-49, actually. The United States Senate is 50-50. And so my hope here is that if you explain how we got here, there could be those folks who say, you know what, that's right. Let's think anew and act anew, as Lincoln said.
Now, you mentioned January 6th, the insurrection at the Capitol. And I'm curious if the idea for Fate of Fact really began with that event, or was this something that you were already thinking about?
No, it's a great question. It really was. I have no original ideas. I've got like five ideas, maybe on a good day, and so they find different forms. And so I'm not pretending that there's anything blindingly original here, but I believe fundamentally that Richard Hofstadter, the Columbia historian, who really is kind of depressing if you do what I do for a living, because he's basically said everything. And did it about 60 years ago, 70 years ago. He wrote an essay in October 1964 called "The Paranoid Style in American Politics." And it was about this inherently dramatic, grievance-driven narrative that was largely on the right, where it wasn't just that the communists were against us. It was that people in high places in the United States were active agents of the communist conspiracy. So you didn't just disagree with Harry Truman. Truman was a communist agent. You didn't just disagree with George Marshall. George Marshall was a communist agent. Eisenhower was that. And so it's the self-fulfilling, self-aggrandizing narrative. And my theory of the case is that one of the reasons the Republican Party was primed to go along with the Trump era was because they have felt betrayed by their champions going back to the Second World War. So if you think about Republican presidents, right, Dwight Eisenhower ends a 20-year drought for Republicans. But what does he do? He functionally ratifies the New Deal. He appoints Earl Warren to be the Chief Justice of the United States, who then gives you a series of Supreme Court cases that continue to inflame the conservative base in the country. You have Richard Nixon in 1968, who runs one way and then comes in, establishes the Environmental Protection Agency, proposes a guaranteed family income, which nobody could do today. Biden couldn't do that today. Proposed a healthcare plan that was actually to the left of Obamacare, appoints four Supreme Court justices, one of whom wrote the Roe versus Wade decision, and he goes to China, thereby betraying this Red China Cold War mentality. Gerald Ford, very much a moderate. President Reagan comes in as kind of the hero of the right, cuts taxes dramatically in 1981, but then raises them five more times, and federal spending rises under Reagan. And Reagan, who was elected with the support of evangelical Christians, never seriously attempts to pass school prayer as an amendment to the Constitution or ban abortion. George H.W. Bush is the proto-example of all this because he governed absolutely from the center, got killed, as he put it, I'm dead meat, you know, high-level Gettysburg address-like rhetoric. And then George W. Bush will tell you that there's a line between TARP and the bailout of Wall Street in 2008 and Trump. And so you have all this gasoline on the floor, and Trump's a match.
In 1964 is kind of where you begin the timeline of this. Again, what is the significance of that year? Why not the beginning of McCarthyism in the 40s and 50s? Why then?
Partly because of Ronald Reagan. On October 27th, 1964, Reagan goes into a TV studio in Los Angeles and delivers a half-hour speech on Barry Goldwater's behalf. It is still called The Speech, capital T, capital S. It's like the Sermon on the Mount delivered by, you know, the GE Theater host. And if you listen to the speech, which I recommend, it is incredibly well argued. It is full of mind-numbing facts. There's a funny clip in the first episode where, and I remember this and I'd listened to it not long ago, but it's just, you know, 68% of 42% of 32%. And you can disagree with it, right? You can say, no, government has a role to play in the marketplace, but the son of a bitch knew his numbers, right?
Oh, he did.
And he spent all those years. I mean, there's a wonderful Hollywood detail here. He didn't like flying in the 50s. And he made his living after his contract at Warner's was up. He made his living being a corporate spokesman for General Electric. He did the Sunday night show. I have two theories about Reagan that are not exactly scholarly. One is not a theory. Ronald Reagan created Opie. Ronnie Howard did a guest shot on GE Theater the night before they were deciding who to cast. And Ron Howard actually credits Reagan with having been really nice on the show and saying something nice about him. The other is that Bonanza won the Cold War because GE Theater was in black and white and Bonanza was in color. And so Haas drove Reagan off the air. And therefore, communism is dead. So that's, again, that hasn't been peer reviewed yet, but I like it. But 64, there are a couple of things going on. Reagan gives the speech. Hofstadter publishes his essay on the paranoid style. And the 1964 was the launch of the Great Society. And the highest recorded moment of public confidence in government. 77% of Americans in the fall of 1964 trusted the federal government to do the right thing, some or most of the time. That number is now 17%. So we went from almost 4 out of 5 Americans to about 1 in 5 believing in government. And so I think all these forces are kind of there, where you have Johnson working off the Kennedy legacy, saying, as Johnson could say in his wonderfully humble way, these are the most important times to be living in since Christ was born in Bethlehem, giving you some idea of where Johnson put himself on the spectrum. And there are all sorts of reasons for that, right? There's Watergate, there's Vietnam, there's Iraq, there's the growing gap in wages and wealth inequality, you know, many, many reasons. But no major party nominated someone, much less elected someone, who was so overtly and consciously a purveyor of fake narrative.
And going back to Reagan's speech and also Trump, Reagan's approach is rather brilliant, because the other thing about it that distinguishes it is he explains his own philosophical journey from Hollywood liberal to free market conservative. We never hear that speech from Donald Trump. Donald Trump, you know, made the exact same journey, although some would say a little bit more cynical and calculated than philosophical. And yet he never gave any explanation of how he went from a New York liberal to an alt-right conservative. And what's worse, nobody cared.
Somebody said today, I mean, there's a thing floating around, might've been on Axios, there's a Trump voter maybe at the Utah convention that booed Mitt Romney. The guy says Trump doesn't lie. He just says things. And if they don't seem to be true, they must be true. I mean, that we're talking, this is 1930s stuff. And I've resisted that for a long time. Now I'm not so sure. You know, democracy is fragile. It hasn't endured this long anywhere else. It would be arrogant and stupid and ahistorical of us to assume that it's always going to work out. So we're living in a world where citizenship, which should never be seasonal, is a stress test, and it's a constant one. And I do think President Biden is part of his popularity is that he's not front and center for us. But the forces that led to January 6th may be receding a bit, but they're only receding from public view. They're not receding in reality. And we have to be forever vigilant against that.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more when we return in just a minute.
I traveled through time to tell you this. Almost everything that happens in politics today has happened before, has been debated before, maybe in slightly different forms. On My History Can Beat Up Your Politics podcast, since 2006, I've been examining the history behind today's politics and adding layers of context to some of today's debates and telling some great stories. I'm Bruce Carlson. Join me at www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com or wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, wherever else you get your podcasts from. Learn how George Washington and FDR supported vaccines in their time. Warren Harding or Ulysses S. Grant took stands on racial justice. John and Abigail Adams and what they had to say about free speech and the press. What Abraham Lincoln had to say on that. What were the conspiracy theories that had to be debated during the debate over the Constitution? Were things more partisan or less partisan in the past? How Mitt Romney's dad broke ranks with the GOP, and Liz Cheney's dad got his start in politics coming from a Democratic family, and many, many other great stories. And another thing, we're balanced on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, so I promise you won't be infuriated even if you don't agree. We take a balanced approach. So listen, www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com.
We have one goal on the Investing for Beginners podcast, and that's to spread education and foundational investing knowledge to all listeners of all backgrounds. If you're looking for eye-opening guest interviews, simplistic breakdowns on current market conditions, and teaching of core investing concepts, you've come to the right place. If you're anything like us, the hardest part of investing was getting started, and that's why we're here. The Investing for Beginners podcast is focused on laying the educational groundwork to teach you how to invest your money to work for you and to allow you to jumpstart your financial independence journey. Subscribe to the Investing for Beginners podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now.
But looking more broadly at this phenomenon of alternative facts and quote-unquote fake news, isn't that something that's always been there? I mean, if we look back at the political campaigns of the 19th century and even some of the founding fathers, there was always deliberate disinformation, outright slander, yellow journalism. Is it really any worse today, or is it merely that it's just amplified and has a farther reach?
There's a slight difference between hyperbole and active fiction. There is a difference between hyperbole and disinformation. And so one of the great examples, 1796 was the first campaign where we wanted to make America great again. And it was Adams versus Jefferson. And, you know, Jefferson was attacked as a French atheist, which seems kind of redundant. Adams was attacked as a hermaphrodite, which I've never understood. So, sure. The brutality of politics is perennial. But, you know, Abraham Lincoln in 1860, when he was running against Stephen Douglas, let me put it this way. Stephen Douglas in 1860 did not say on the day after the election, it was stolen. And in fact, there were plans to try to disrupt the Electoral College count in 1860-61. And Winfield Scott, the head of the military at the time, shut it down. So hyperbole, division, passion, absolutely. We could spend the next 5 years talking about examples of that. But an American president and the leader of one of the two major parties actively disseminating clearly false information and having that information be accepted as true by an extraordinary number of otherwise seemingly normal Americans is different.
Well, I want to ask you then, because Whenever I talk to historians like yourself about current events, I'm always surprised that they can usually come up with a precedent or a comparable moment in American history for just about anything, even when it comes to a lot of this alt-right populism and some of the more shocking events of the Trump presidency. But I have thought really hard, and I cannot come up with anything comparable to January 6th. Is that truly an unprecedented event?
I think it's the Civil War is the example where you had two competing visions of reality that we adjudicated on the battlefield. The Confederate states, the rebellious states, had their own interpretation of religion. They had their own interpretation of the Constitution. They had their own interpretation of race, which was interestingly more widely shared in the North than we tend to remember. And we had to adjudicate it by the sword. And whenever you say since the Civil War, you need to be careful. And I say that with all care. I wrote a book about this. I can find all sorts of things where, you know, FDR in 1933, there was a Wall Street plot to throw him out of the White House because he was changing capitalism. You had Huey Long on the left, you had Douglas MacArthur on the right. FDR, on the night he took the oath of office, was having a glass of whiskey and going to bed like a good Episcopalian. And an aide came to him and said, "Mr. President, if you succeed in solving the Depression, you'll go down as our greatest president. But if you fail, you'll go down as our worst." And FDR looked at him and said, "If I fail, I'll go down as our last." So I can play that game all day. The distinction there, though, is that in 1932 and in 1936, neither Herbert Hoover nor Alf Landon played the Trumpian role. So it is different. You mentioned amplification. I do think the social media, in some ways, the cable world is a return to a 18th and 19th century partisan media. We do have a machinery of perpetual conflict that just requires fuel, and it doesn't matter the quality of the fuel. It can be Dr. Seuss one day and insurrection the next. But nobody gets up at a cable network and scans the headlines at 5 a.m. and says, "You know what? There's nothing to talk about today. We're just going to take the day off." Right? So everything comes at you at the same level. And so I have a totally parenthetical thought, for what it's worth, that when the archaeologists of our democracy go through everything someday, one cause for the lack of trust and the rising temperature is going to be that, and we're moving away from this generationally, but that the cable news world, which is now almost entirely partisan, is presented in a vernacular that we initially adopted in this country for the transmission of news and not opinion, right? So you still have a person sitting at a desk with an image behind them talking into a camera. And that made the shift from information to more propaganda, more insidious.
Right, because they have a level of authority when they're in that position. You're absolutely right. And one thing that keeps coming to me, you mentioned the John Birchers several times in this podcast in 1964 and how the Republicans, including George Herbert Walker Bush, were able to drive the Birchers out of the party. Why were we so unsuccessful 50 years later?
Because it became the party. That's my point, is that the Birchers were still an element of the party in 1960 and 64. The party, I believe, because of this narrative of grievance and betrayal and ironically victimhood, right? The world is arrayed against them. The Birchers believe the world was arrayed against them, but they were few in number. 60 years later, I believe that the experience of grievance went mainstream. And I don't think anybody, and I'm sitting in Nashville, Tennessee, I suspect the demography of my street, we are the blue dot, I would imagine. Maybe there's another one or two, but not many. You know, I've got a neighbor who had a Trump flag made 5 years ago. You can imagine our barbecues are a lot of fun. But I'm not saying that they went, you know, when Jeb Bush and Rubio and those guys collapsed, I don't think they all sat there and said, you know what, this is a lot like Eisenhower ratifying the New Deal. I'm going to, no, they're not thinking that way. But what they are thinking is they didn't want Hillary Clinton raising their taxes or picking judges. They didn't really want Biden to do it, but enough of them came through. I think it's, and this goes to your good early question, which is, how do you reach people who don't want to be reached? And to my mind, I'm not a doctor, thankfully, for everybody, but it's a little like a checkup, right? And sometimes you get good news and sometimes you get bad news. And sometimes they tell you to lose 10 pounds. And sometimes they tell you, we got to do something about that, you know, that mole or whatever. And this is a diagnosis. And it may be wrong. I'm often wrong. But I think there's something here. And what I hope is that people who have become captive to their own narrative of grievance, while attacking everybody else who seems to be aggrieved, may be able to see that this cognitive dissonance is bad for the country they profess to love. And I love this country. You know, I'm not William Lloyd Garrison, you know, who burned the Constitution in the 1850s and said it was a pact with the devil. I'm with Frederick Douglass, who said there's no soil so congenial to grow the growth of reform than American soil. But if you believe that, then you have to defend these principles. And one of the principles is reason matters.
You were friends with George H.W. Bush. You spoke at his funeral, also Barbara Bush's funeral, wrote his biography. He really represented that dying breed of the Republican Party. Did you ever speak with him about what happened to this country in the past 5 years? Can you give us some insight into how he viewed all this?
The president died in 18. He was kind of befuddled by Trump. I think that might be a little strong. What I think it's safe to say that he saw this as the flowering of the plants he had tried to prune starting in the 60s. And there's a wonderful diary entry. It's in one of the episodes from 88. Remember, Pat Robertson ran for president in 88 and won a straw poll in Michigan. And I think did really well in Iowa. And there was a woman who walked up to Bush, vice president of the United States. And whether you agree or disagree with George Bush, he was, you know, a nice man. And she starts spewing at him, a lot of staring at him and being unkind. And he dictated into his diary of the tape recorder. And he said later, it's just ugly, 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 and no compromise. They're trying to take over the party. You know, his father had been in the Senate from Connecticut. He really did believe that the party had to represent different points of view. He was right in the middle of it. And to some extent, his political, the price he paid politically as president was that he, as his son would later say, he misunderestimated the right swing of the party. For Bush Sr., it's a complicated question, obviously, because of his sons. Right. He had a two-term. But what I think is, and he's out there talking about immigration, and George W. Bush couldn't get nominated today in that party in a 20-year cycle. 20 years.
Well, as we wind down here, then I have to ask, is the GOP a lost cause? Is it redeemable? Or are we headed to a three-party system pretty soon? What do you think?
Lost cause, we should have a separate conversation about that phrase. I think that's right. The problem, one of the structural issues in American politics is because of the Electoral College, it is very hard for a third party to win a national election. Because if you can't win 270 plus, you end up in the House. And therefore, Bloomberg looked at this for 15 years. You can probably get to 40% plurality, but you can't get the 51% you need in the Electoral College. I think it would be good, just personal opinion, I think it'd be good for the country if, as happened in the 1960s, as happened at various points in our history, if the various elements of the parties were to reassess themselves. But you can't, here's a fearful note. You know, the Republican Party right now is going to have to lose a couple of more elections before they see any reason for it, right? Because they don't believe, 60, 70% of the Republicans who answer polls say they don't believe they lost. So until you lose a couple, you can't be forced into a reckoning, a rethinking, which again, and I'm not even a Democrat, but it only took the Democrats losing two elections, 80 and 84, to get them to rethink. And then they lost in 88. But you know, the Democratic reorientation, which is now seems to be more of a detour, given where Biden is governing, but they respond, it's an interesting thing. They responded to reality.
Right. Exactly.
Right. And right now, you know, if you look at the House caucus, if you look at, you know, some of these senators, what you see is a bunch of folks who aren't interested in rethinking their positions. They're interested in retaking the White House. And if you're interested in retaking as opposed to rethinking, then you're on a course that I suspect will end up being, I hope will end up being deleterious to them, because I think, not because I disagree with every policy presented by a Republican, but I do disagree fundamentally with a party that has made itself a vehicle for a personality as opposed to a vehicle for ideas.
Yeah, yeah. This whole mentality of tit for tat and owning the liberals really is a cancer in the conservative movement. But that's a conversation for another time. Once again, John Meacham's new podcast is called Fate of Fact. You can listen to new episodes every Wednesday and go subscribe wherever you like to listen to podcasts. John Meacham, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much.
Thanks again to John Meacham for coming on the podcast. Subscribe to his new podcast, Fate of Fact, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. And follow him on Twitter at John Meacham or at johnmeacham.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, then subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Detailed reviews are the best way for new listeners to discover the show. Follow us on Facebook at KickAssNewsPod and email me with your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. KickAss News is a part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com and check out some of our other shows like Food with Mark Bittman, Movie Therapy, Investing for Beginners, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, and many others. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.
An Airwave Media Podcast.